The following is brought to you by Will Harris, Dustin Campbell, Daily Tech News Show, Andy Beach, Nick Wood, and Craig.
Hello and welcome everybody to the Politics podcast for what day is it today? November 10th, 2021. It's your old pal Justin Robert Young joining you back in Austin, Texas. A little stuffed up. Might have gotten a little bug. Tell you what, it was Yeah, this is the first time I've gotten sick in like 3 years because I don't get sick often. I certainly did not get sick during COVID because I was by and large, you know, when I wasn't traveling, I was pretty much just kind of by myself or with, you know, two or three people that I saw that were kind of in our pod. So didn't catch COVID. And then I was out and I came back and I'm like, oh my God, I'm getting sick. Oh, good Lord. And then, of course, immediately I thought I had COVID, so got tested. Don't have COVID, but just a regular old sore throat and a runny nose, you know? Turns out you can still get garden variety sick. But the news does not stop. We've got a possibly consequential move here when it comes to the 2022 senatorial control. Somebody that was thought to be maybe the most slam dunk Republican candidate, Chris Sununu of New Hampshire, ain't running. We get into that announcement, what it means, who might replace him, and more. You know, I'm going to go on a rant here in our second segment. Can we knock it off with thinking that every stupid meme that these dipwad politicians put out is like a declaration of war? Because Paul Gozer put out some anime meme that I'm sure just got all the 8-coon subscribers, all their bingers erect, puts it up on Twitter. And now all of a sudden we get into, I'll save it. We'll get into it in a minute. Also, Bill Scheer, Washington Monthly. We have ridden with him throughout the entirety of the infrastructure process. And it was only right that we bring him here as it has now wrapped up late in the evening, Friday night. The bipartisan infrastructure bill passed, delinking it from the Build Back Better bill. Was it worth it? Who comes out the winner? Are there any lessons to be learned? Old Billy Scheer explains it all to us.
I do believe that is our civic responsibility to the entire country. We have to continue to be that example of how to work through our differences without destroying that sense of community. But my responsibility is not to the gridlock and politics of Washington, it's to the citizens of New Hampshire. And I'd rather push myself 120 miles an hour delivering wins for New Hampshire than to slow down, end up on Capitol Hill debating partisan politics without results. That's why I'm going to run for a fourth term, and I'd be honored if the people of New Hampshire would elect me again as their governor. We have a lot more to do to protect the interests of New Hampshire citizens.
And it's that is that Chris Sununu, the governor of New Hampshire, saying that he will not run against Senator Maggie Hassan. He will instead seek another 2-year term as governor in the live free or die state. Now, 2 weeks ago, this would have been very bleak news for the GOP's hopes to take the Senate. Not only do the Republicans need to defend all of their seats, but they've got to win at least one net at the end of the midterms in less than a year. And New Hampshire and Sununu were the closest things to a lock that the GOP had. An October poll had Sununu over Hassan by 3 points. Now, that's also with Sununu being a Republican governor in a state that has trended blue. Somebody that has had to deal with being a leader through COVID, which has not been a particularly, a popular thing to be. And while surely there are some wailing and gnashing of teeth behind the scenes in Republican circles, I don't know if it's as bad as if it would have happened 2 weeks ago. Because Virginia happened last Tuesday, and New Jersey happened only an hour after that. Hassan won in 2016 by, 4 figures. This was not a lot of people that she won by. And it appears that the battlefield might be tilted even more toward Republicans in 2022 than it was then. Still, Sununu in this environment might have been a set it and forget it for the GOP. It would have allowed them to pump money into other races that may or may not be closer in the new world we find ourselves in, including Herschel Walker in Georgia and attempting to pry Mark Kelly's seat away from him in Arizona. Now, we're going to spend a lot of time with our boy Evan Scrimshaw breaking down not only what happened in Virginia, but also looking ahead to the midterms as we are, breaking down specifically in the Senate where we are in a post-Sununu begging out of this world. But if we are in a situation a year from now where Joe Biden is still a less than popular president and the Republicans are able to continue hammering education, which was a very effective cudgel for them in these off year elections, then the idea that an out-of-nowhere Republican could challenge Maggie Hassan is more plausible than it was before when everybody was still going on 2020 math. So, this is according to Politico. With Sununu out of the race, we have speculation that the former senator, Kelly Ayotte, could challenge Hassan again. Ayotte was the one who lost very barely to Hassan 6 years ago. But according to sources, she's not going to do it. So that is a larger problem because now you don't have a former senator and now you don't have a popular sitting governor. So the question then becomes, okay, well, who else we got? Former Senator Scott Brown. He drives a truck. Remember him? He used to be the senator in Massachusetts. His seat then went to Elizabeth Warren. He moved to New Hampshire for an unsuccessful challenge to Democratic Senator Jeanne Sheehan in 2014, but he will not run for Senate this year, instead focusing on his wife's congressional campaign. So that leaves Gail Huff Brown, a former TV news reporter. He's running against Representative Chris Pappas and Matt Mowers. And if you are listening to those names and you're like, who? Well, then you can understand what situation the Republicans find themselves in. This is a bummer if you're a Republican. This is ecstatic news if you're a Democrat. Because again, the Republicans only need to win one seat net right now. Pennsylvania looks like a really complicated situation. We'll get into Georgia, Nevada, Colorado, and more, Arizona, in our Friday episode. But this is going to be tough sledding for the Republicans. And taking a win off the table when all you needed was one win for sure, well, that ain't great. Okay. So there's this thing that's happening lately. You know, you had AOC come out the other day and say, you know, the phrase woke is now being used as a pejorative. It's only being used by people who don't like the causes that theoretically the woke elements of society purport to serve. It has now become politically a liability. So she looks to say, hey, why are we using this catch-all term? To which I would say, I don't know, man. Blame like Childish Gambino and DeRay's t-shirts circa 7 years ago if you want to blame why people are saying woke. Woke had become a thing. But anyway, all right. So seasons change. No, don't use woke anymore. Use the actual issues that you are talking about. That's what you want to do. And I'm actually in favor of that. I tend to also think that saying things like, oh, well, this is the woke crowd or the woke position can be a bit, as the kids say, cringe. Not because I think that it's a negative thing per se. I just think that now it's kind of been stretched beyond all usefulness. But there's another thing that annoys me. And before we even get into it, let me talk about the person who's at the center of this issue. Paul Gozer. Listeners to this show know Paul Gozer as a representative of Congress from Arizona. He is somebody that is apparently so detestable that not one, not two, not three, not four, but five of his own siblings united in a negative campaign ad against him. That campaign ad was unsuccessful because he wound up going back to Congress. Paul Gozer is a conservative edgelord. He is somebody that is prone to tweeting the thing that gets him the attention from the very online right. He was one of the people that was at the forefront of the January 6th stuff. He is surely going to be brought up during the January 6th hearings for meeting with protesters that eventually wound up inside the Capitol. He is, by and large, among the most look at me members of Congress that we got. And so it should come as no surprise that Paul Gozer tweeted out a anime parody that put him at the center of, you know, as the main character, basically. Why? Because a lot of the online right are really into anime. A lot of people are really into anime, but a lot of people on the online right are really into anime. And so he's communicating with his base, the very online right. Now, that's not the people that vote for him, but in a world where you can raise small dollar donations from anybody just by being a character on Twitter, this is part of the game. So he tweets this thing out, and it's not even really all that good or well done. There's not a whole lot of original animation. It's just sort of like a anime intro song where a lot of the kind of like images that are setting up the story are like migrants coming to the border. Eventually, there is an animated sequence where, and I swear to God, dude, it is blink and you miss it. The Paul Gozer character is running toward a gigantic behemoth of a monster. For a split second, you see AOC's face on the monster. This is probably because the person who was making this was doing it for the lulz and didn't want to take the time to actually do this well, so they did it very quickly. and the Paul Gosar character leaps into the air of the gigantic super monster AOC and slices it in half with a sword. There's then a bunch more pictures of Donald Trump and Paul Gosar and blah, 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 Joe Biden. And then eventually you see a gigantic and even larger Joe Biden super monster that Paul Gosar's character is leaping to attack. And it's that freeze frame that ends the intro. This is stupid. I mean, it's S-posting, as they say on the internet. It's just some stuff to make people chuckle. Is it a physical threat to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? Do we wonder that Paul Gosar is going to Naruto run down the halls of Congress and then brandishing his samurai sword slice into the congresswoman from New York? Do we worry that he's going to jump off a building and attack Joe Biden, who has grown 3 stories since we last saw him? No. It's just some dumb stuff. Now, is it in poor taste? Sure. And if it just ended with somebody saying, hey, it's in poor taste, whatever, weeb, then I would understand that. But no, this has now become a counter reaction for the Democrats. The counter reaction is he should be taken off whatever leadership positions he's in. This is a death threat toward the president and a member of Congress. Blah, blah, blah. This is like the thing when Trump, you know, posted the meme of him during WrestleMania where he was like clotheslining Vince McMahon, but instead of it being Vince McMahon, it was CNN, you know, over Vince McMahon said, and it's like, oh, Trump is instigating violence against journalists. He's instigating clotheslines against journalists. He's not. It's just a meme. I honestly think that the more Democrats get worked up about stuff like this, the more it just makes them look so intensely stupid and lame. And I guess it's like, whatever, they're in Congress. What else are they going to do, right? Except yell at each other. But I mean, I guess that's the other thing, is that it really just does blow my mind that the Democrats really haven't learned their lesson from Trump. Like, yeah, he's going to do some dumb stuff. Guess what? The anime parody of Paul Gosar isn't mainstream. The only reason why it's mainstream is if it becomes a controversy. So the more you want to make it a controversy, the more mainstream it's going to be. You are making it mainstream. Although on the other hand, if by whatever metrics their Act Blue accounts get fat every time they go after some weeb edgelord congressman, then maybe that explains it. It's just, maybe I'm sick. Enough with pretending all the memes are actually death threats. Look, they're not. They're memes. And you should make memes too. Memes are fun. I don't know. I just like memes. I said this to the folks who listen to the Sunday show, but I got a new way that I believe I should be talking about this show and you should be talking about this show to your friends. And that is this. Politics, politics, politics is the only crowdsourced national traveling reporter in America. Whenever I go to Tulsa and risk my health so I can cover that disaster of a Trump rally, whenever I go to Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina, whenever I go to Georgia for the runoffs, whenever I go to New York City for the mayoral primary. Whenever I go to Virginia for that governor's race, oh, I see the same people in all those press pens. I see the same people, and they are from every outlet that you know covers politics. But I don't see another me. I don't see another crowd-funded national traveling reporter. You make that happen. You listening, make that happen by going to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. And for your troubles, oh, baby, you get that Sunday edition on Monday, where I break down all the Sunday talk shows. You get the late edition on Thursday. Friends, this is my dream. You make all of this come true. And I got a little hint. That $3 club, $3 a week, that gets you all that bonus content. Oh, we might have more bonus content coming to you soon. We might have more bonus content. Maybe, dare I say it, for a period of time, that small $3 a week spend could get you, not forever, but maybe for a little while, 5 days worth of content, a piece of content each and every day of the work week. Huh. Pretty cool. Pretty cool. Maybe some announcements on that coming soon. But for now, TakePoliticsSeriously.com is where you need to go. $3 gets you 2 bonus episodes per week. Our guest today is no stranger to the show. You can find his writing in Washington Monthly. He is the man that helps us keep track of the tactics in Congress. Ladies and gentlemen, Bill Scheer. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Always good to talk to you.
All right. It feels like the most Biden administration possible thing that could happen, a once in several decades moment of infrastructure investment for America passes. I think even respectable Friday news dumps happen at some point between 6 and 8. This was into the like midnight hours of Friday. Let's first start here. How close to what happened was what you had assumed would happen, that Nancy Pelosi would move forward and that Republicans would eventually peel off and make it happen for her?
Well, I don't want to act like I'm like super duper clairvoyant and I called every step of the way exactly as it happened, because that's not the case. I think there are a couple of big picture things that I've been saying and, you know, getting dragged for repeatedly on the internet,
yeah,
that have proven true. The biggest one is that bipartisanship is still possible, which, yeah, I've been saying for a long time, even though it's a very polarized environment, even though Republicans can be very malevolent and not, you know, put country before party, but that doesn't mean you can't find the common ground at times. But you got to try to find it. If your narrative is Republicans are monstrous to the core and will never do anything decent for any reason whatsoever, then you don't try, and then you can't get that kind of win. And there are plenty of points along the way here when there would be negotiations on the Senate side and there'd be setbacks, and you'd see punditry, and you'd see a Democratic politician say, pull the plug, waste of time,
yeah,
they're never going to do it. And the people in the room obviously had a different read on the situation, thought there was an opening, and they found the opening. When it kicked to the House and it was September and Democrats couldn't get over the finish line and the Republican problem solvers, the more moderate Republicans, were not stepping up,
Yeah.
You know, at that point I was like, I can't trust those guys. They had their moment and they're carrying from the moment. And yet here we are in at the end of top of November. Not only did it pass the House, Republicans were the margin of victory in the House. Yes. And they were the margin of victory in the Senate as well. So you can't, I mean, maybe the odds aren't with you, but you can't get that 5% shot panning out unless you try. And they did try.
This was
That's bipartisan. One big
thing. Yeah, this was bipartisan from stem to stern, right? Like this was Sinema and Portman in the Senate. Mm-hmm. Joe Manchin obviously played a large role. But Mitch McConnell wound up voting for it, which is, I think, something that kind of gets forgotten.
Championing it. He's been running a victory lap in the past 24 hours. Yep. This has been great for Kentucky.
But the one thing I would say for the Republican problem solvers is that it never actually came to a vote. Until it came to a vote on Friday, right? Because they're the House Republican leadership, at least according to reports from Kevin McCarthy, was all right. I'll cut you loose to vote for it if they get the votes by themselves. They didn't get the votes by themselves, and the problem solvers wound up, you know, jumping leadership no matter what.
Some of them. I mean, it wasn't all of them. You know, there's 29 Republican problem solvers and 13 did.
13 did.
And they came in. They didn't wait till it hit 218 and then jumped on the bandwagon. They were voting for it before it was 218, making clear that Pelosi had the vote so long as the vast majority of Democrats stayed on board. A lot of trust was required here on all sides.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been through a period of mistrust. We were seeing Democrats mistrust Republicans at the onset. At least a lot of the progressive Democrats were saying, don't bother with them. You can't trust them. And then as that deal began to take shape, you started seeing Democrats mistrust other Democrats.
Yes.
And the whole hostage taking strategy of the progressives, we're not going to pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill until you pass the broader Build Back Better bill. And by holding on to this, we're going to have better leverage over that bill. I mean, that strategy kicked into gear. I mean, it was already articulated in June, really kicked into gear in August once the Senate bill passed. That strategy did not help anybody.
Yeah.
Except maybe Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who said, I'm not impressed with your hostage taking. I'm still going to cut this Build Back Better bill down to a size that makes me comfortable. And the Democratic numbers sagged, Biden's numbers sagged. They looked like they were squabbling, looked like they couldn't get their act together. And it wasn't until Pramila Jayapal and the House moderates looked each other in the eye and said, look, if you do the infrastructure bill first, we're going to be there for you on the bigger bill. You're just going to have to take my word and trust me on this. And Biden telling Jayapal, I'll get you those Senate votes. I know Manchin and Sinema haven't signed the dotted line yet, but I'm going to get you those votes. That, and then Pelosi had to have the trust that those 13 Republicans were going to show up because she knew that the hardcore squad, AOC, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, and a few others, they were not going to come around, and she needed at least a few Republicans to be the margin of victory. And she put it to the floor without having those Republicans go on the record and commit to doing that. She had to tell her privately, and she had to believe it. That you can't get things done without trust. And so hopefully that's the takeaway lesson that people, you know, get from this process.
Does this happen if Terry McAuliffe wins in Virginia? Does it happen on Friday?
Well, here's one of the things that I'd say I got wrong. Because one thing I got right was early on, Pelosi said some things. She used some very careful language that said to me, this progressive demand for linkage of the two bills, Pelosi is not 100% on board with. No matter what the impression is. I even had Pelosi's spokesperson challenge me on Twitter.
Your mentions,
Twice tell me that I was wrong and that the Senate bill had to go first. And I was like, okay, guy, but I'm just looking at what she's saying and that doesn't square. And she made that clear at the end of September where she said, look, hey, things have changed in the Senate. You know, Manchin's not going to do what we want to do. And this highway trust fund deadline is rapidly approaching at the end of September. We need to extend the life of that fund, which the infrastructure bill does, or else money is going to dry up for road and transit projects. And I accepted what Pelosi said on face value. That was a real pressure point for action. And it wasn't, because not only can you pass a stopgap bill separately to keep that alive, it didn't require new money just yet. There was enough money in the kitty to keep it going at no extra cost. And Republicans were willing to go along. You know, I would have thought, and I did think, that Mitch McConnell would say, hey, you want the highway trust fund? Pass the gosh darn infrastructure bill that I helped you pass.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
You're like, you don't need our help. But they threw Democrats a bit of a lifeline and said, hey, we'll let you squabble amongst yourselves for another few weeks and keep this thing going. And that happened in September, and it happened in October. And I thought at the end of October, okay, maybe there won't be money in the kitty this time around. And you have Virginia looming. You have this fear that McAuliffe is going to lose, and maybe Democrats, maybe Biden would say, hey, I don't want to have that on our shoulders. I don't want to risk Democrats going into a, you know, more fierce circular firing squad after a McAuliffe loss. Let's get this over the finish line ahead of time and try to give that guy a boost. That doesn't happen.
No, nope.
It's only McAuliffe losing. This is the only thing I can discern from this. McAuliffe losing was the wake up call that made Biden, because apparently Pelosi was leaning on Biden. Pelosi wanted to do this before the Virginia election, and Biden was hesitating. And Biden seemed to be very reluctant to win ugly, to twist arms. He wanted to win, but he wanted everyone to be very kumbaya about it. And it took Pelosi saying, look, now is the time. We cannot wait any longer. And that apparently moved Biden to finally call the progressives and say, look, I want you to do this today. I'm sick of losing. I'm sick of my numbers going down mid-40s, possibly below 40, depending on what poll you look at. And that scared everybody straight.
I'm going to give you a few more whacks here at this dead horse, but please lay out for everybody listening the absolute failure that the linkage hostage taking strategy was for the progressive Democrats in the House now that it has been delinked and they have lost that leverage.
Well, I think this is important, it's not important because it makes Bill share right. Like that's the least important thing in the universe.
No. But you were right. So please go ahead.
And it's also not important to be like, moderates are awesome, progressives suck. Like it's not about spiking the football and like cheering one faction over another. That's not the point. The point is learning what tactics work, learning the importance of reading power dynamics to develop good strategies. Progressives told themselves that Manchin and Sinema were adversaries who didn't want to do this or want to do it in a very reduced way and needed to be forced to do the right thing, needed to be squeezed and publicly pressured and shamed and to take something that they wanted badly and trade it for what they didn't want to get done. So they take the infrastructure bill hostage at the end of essentially the end of September, officially, when they didn't pass that bill. But even before that point, said we're not going to do this. And when that first happened, the intended Build Back Better bill was to be $3.5 trillion. And right now, and everything that's happened since the relinkage occurred at the end of September, all the negotiation has been cutting that bill down. The top line and the White House offer is now half of $3.5 trillion. It's $1.75. And they've already jettisoned various chunks of the bill. They've gotten rid of free community college. They've gotten rid of a good chunk of the Medicare expansion, and maybe it'll end up being all the Medicare expansion. They appear to be getting rid of paid leave, for it's a paid leave, although the House tried to tuck it back in, but Manchin has already said no go on that. They got rid of the clean energy payment program, which is supposed to be the centerpiece of the climate portion. There's no gain. There's no progressive gain that's happened in this process. And I'm hearing a lot of reverse engineering spin from the progressive side. Well, Manchin Sinema didn't want this at all. And so the fact that we're on the verge of getting something, that's proof that this tactic worked. And there's two reasons why I don't accept that. You know, one is that the various progressive people have said, you know, AOC said this should be $10 trillion. Bernie said there should be $6 trillion. Jamal Bowman at one point said anything south of $5.4 trillion is unacceptable.
Yeah.
When they had the $3.5 trillion budget resolution, the consistent talking point was $3.5 trillion is the compromise.
Yes.
Because we set these higher benchmarks before. This is the compromise. Well, if that is the compromise, how is it half of what it was before? And on top of that, because they have told themselves that what Manchin and Sinema really want is nothing. They want nothing. And we're forcing them to accept something. All that did was give Manchin and Sinema more leverage.
Yes.
Because when Manchin said in July, in a written statement to Chuck Schumer, it wasn't publicly known at the time, but we know it now. He put on paper, I guarantee I will do $1.5 trillion with these various conditions.
Yeah.
So we know that's where he was in July. So when Manchin says to Bernie in October, as was reported by a couple of senators in the room to list to Axios, when Manchin tells Bernie, I'm comfortable with zero.
Yes.
You might have said, I don't think that's true because you put on a piece of paper 2 months ago, 3 months ago, that you're for 1.5. So I call your bluff. Instead, Progressive said, yeah, that's what he really wants. He wants zero. So I'm going to take whatever Manchin gives me, because I believe what he really wants is zero. Manchin's threat to walk was far more credible because progressives told themselves
that he was going to walk.
They told themselves that he was essentially the worst of the worst. This is just a corporatist. He owns a coal business. He has, and Sinema is a total hack who's in the pocket of the pharmaceutical industry. And hey, maybe things are true to some extent, but you also should have realized, I think, that there are things that they wanted out of the bill. These are people that like to deliver things.
Yeah.
They want to say they did something. Sinema ran in 2018. People like to say, oh, she's betraying what she ran on. Well, go look at what she did run on. Look at what the ads did say. They said, I'm going to be a bipartisan, independent problem solver.
Yeah.
She wants to go back to her state and say, I did this for you. I made things happen. I'm the one who crafted this in a way that was palatable to a broad cross-section of the state. And Manchin's reason of existence has to be, I can do things for you that if you had a Republican in the seat, he or she wouldn't be able to do. So they have reasons to do stuff. They want to do it on their terms. But I don't think it was plausible that they deep down wanted to kill it. And progressives telling himself that weakened their leverage and gave Manchin Sinema more leverage.
I think the other thing that you can now look back on and say absolutely backfired is the idea that, okay, so the Congressional Progressive Caucus blocks and takes hostage this infrastructure bill. At that point, now this is a pressure campaign on Manchin and Sinema specifically. Here's the problem. Joe Manchin, the more you yell at him, the stronger he becomes with his core constituency in West Virginia. He it is almost like trying to be mad at like Turning Point USA by sending Antifa to their door. Like it would be that it is that level of a self-own. That's exactly what he wants, is to wave at progressive activists from his houseboat. It benefits him in almost every conceivable political way. Sinema, I think you had a thread that you put out on Twitter, and I would also recommend, there was a great Mother Jones piece about Kyrsten Sinema a few months ago about where she came from. She came from political activism. And she very much got sick of the idea that political activism was an infighting, circular firing squad that never really got anything done. And so that's very much built up her entire worldview of being a politician and reaching across the aisle to get done what can get done. And the thing that you put out on Twitter was her leading a campaign to beat back a gay marriage ban by completely omitting gay marriage and by focusing on where that bill overreached and would strike down other domestic partnerships. She's about the win. She cares not for the pressure because she used to put the pressure on and realized how little it really got her. So the idea that that was going to be the squeeze to me was always going to be a failure point. And now it was. And Pramila Jayapal and the Congressional Progressive Caucus are left on Friday with exactly the same deal that they blew through with the moderates twice, which is a promise that right. The moderates will vote based on a condition that may or may not be met.
Yeah, but I think trust is good. I think she should have accepted that word. I think sure. We should get back to trust. But I just want to clarify one thing. I shared that thread, but I didn't write the thread.
No. You shared it. Yes.
And a key part of that thread was not just that she did the kind of pragmatic thing to get that win, but that her lesson from it was that it is useful to use the left flank as a foil. It is useful yes. to do the thing that they don't want to be done. She said at one point, If you, to the activists, you don't like the messages in this ad, that tells me it's a good ad. Yes. So she has a fundamental disrespect for the political strategic thinking of the left. And no, there's a legitimate argument.
I do think if you read that Mother Jones piece, it's because she came from it. Like that, yeah. Like yeah. Her disdain for the activist class is based on her time spent within the activist class.
Now, it was not unreasonable, ludicrous to think that Sinema is reading Arizona wrong, that it's a bluing state, that it needs robust base turnout, it needs Hispanic vote, it needs Native American vote. And Sinema's attempt to be the second incarnation of John McCain and be all mavericky is the wrong political bet to make. And if you show her, if you pressure her and you show her that her numbers are dropping, particularly amongst base voters, that she might worry about a primary challenge and change course. I get the surface logic of that strategy, but we see how it works in practice. People don't like to be told that they're wrong. People don't like to be humiliated publicly. So yeah. Even if Sinema is totally wrong, her reaction was to double and triple down and insist that things get done the way she believes it should be done. And she's the one with the vote and you're not. So, I mean, that story about the gay marriage battle, you got to read people's, I mean, it's hard to do obviously from the outside, but you got to read people's, innermost thoughts as best you can. If it's known that she has disrespect for left-wing political strategery,
yeah,
then maybe that kind of tactic wasn't the best kind of tactic to do. And you're left with, now again, perhaps they were going to call the shots anyway, because they're the 50th vote in the Senate, one or the other or both. But I would have gone about it from the get-go. In January, I would have read the situation as, look, these two are 49 and 50. For whatever we want to do in reconciliation, and even when I want to get to 60, I'm going to need these people. Let's break bread early. Let's talk what they want and what they don't want and figure out what we can do together that's going to fit within their comfort zone, because I'm probably not going to be able to break them. I'm not going to squeeze them and humiliate them to get what I want. And they didn't seem to have come to that realization until this week.
Yeah, I still remain of the opinion that when it comes to Sinema, if the worst thing that can happen to me is in a purple state, that all that could happen is in many, many years from now, I face a more progressive challenger in a primary when no matter what, the general is going to be competitive because the Republicans will have at least a puncher's chance in Arizona. And I can always run on, well, if you elect this person, they're definitely going to lose. I'll take that 11 out of 11 opportunities.
Well, and that's the lesson of Virginia, that
yeah.
Virginia is still a bluing state. It is much more blue than it was 20 years ago. The demographic patterns have not changed all of a sudden.
Yeah.
But it is not solid blue, and there can be circumstances where pendulums still swing in states like that. And Arizona is less blue than Virginia. Sinema is a hell of a lot better position to survive in a state like Arizona, because she can say, I got Sinema Portman passed.
Yes.
I got these infrastructure funds to our state. I was the critical figure. If I wasn't here, maybe this doesn't get done. There's a certain pride sometimes voters take from that my senator is in the thick of things. Now, that can always can backfire on you sometimes, depending on what gets produced. But that's the bet that she has made. And that bet looks a whole lot better after the way Virginia has just gone.
So let's talk about the state of the Build Back Better bill. The one thing I would argue for in the voice of the progressives is that I do think that no matter what, we were going to end up here. So if the point for them was either we fight and see whether or not something else can fall out of the tree, or we just capitulate and this $6 trillion dream, $10 trillion dream gets whittled down to 1.5 anyway, it's worth it to put up the fight if we have the ability to. But now we're here. We have Joe Manchin, who seems ever reluctant to move this along at any kind of expedient pace. Do you believe that the Build Back Better bill gets passed? And if so, when?
I think it's passed. I think it's passed probably by December 3rd, which is the pinch point for keeping the government open and perhaps getting the debt ceiling raised. And then you might have to do the debt ceiling through reconciliation. So that's why I think Build Back Better and debt ceiling are going to be on the same track.
Okay.
There's a bit of a concern that because of the infrastructure bill, there's a general fund transfer of money out of the general fund into the highway trust fund. If it's out of the general fund, that gets you closer to hitting the debt ceiling. And so yeah, you might have to raise the debt ceiling earlier than December 3rd, or there's some legal argument that maybe that's not true. I think the lawyers are trying to sort that out in the White House. But I think Democrats are resigned to raising the debt limit through reconciliation, not expecting Republican votes for it. And therefore they got to get their ducks on the row with the rest of the bill by then. And I think Manchin and Sinema recognize that, you know, one, they're doers. They want to do things. They want to say that they're the ones that got it done. And I think the vast majority of Democrats, progressive and moderate, realize they rise and fall together. If 2020 is going to be a disastrous midterm, you know, it's the moderates that get the brunt of it first. So they're not, they don't have a great incentive to kneecap Biden and humiliate him. Even in the name of great centrism, if the progressive base is totally deflated because they got bupkis, you know, even the most moderate Democrat in a swing district needs the base vote to show up. So they can't be completely dismissive and disregarding of their feelings. So I think everybody gets that. And I think, you know, they're a few yards from the goal line at this point. And I think they're going to get there.
Now, what will be there when they get there, I think, is the larger question, because we have seen one by one many of the center points that when, let's say, Bernie Sanders, who to me puzzlingly was the lead cheerleader for this for much of the summer and into the fall, all the things that he was talking about on why this was an important bill seems to have fallen out one by one by one. So is this at the end of it going to be something that progressives will jump up and down for?
I mean, that's a good question. Progressives are, historically speaking, at least recent history, not inclined to clap at the compromise. They've been more inclined to grouse. And you know, right now, you know, Jayapal is being a cheerleader. Jayapal has now is being a champion for compromise.
Yes.
And she got a fair amount of cred from progressives for the way she handled things up until this point. So we'll see if she has enough stature to keep that going. I saw AOC had a message for her constituents where, you know, she voted no on the infrastructure bill.
Yep.
But she was expressing some hope that even without the loss leverage, they would still get a Build Back Better bill that would be acceptable to them. And in that email that she sent around, she praised the current plan for $550 billion for climate. And she could have very easily poo-pooed that and say that it's not enough, that it's far short of a full-blown Green New Deal. It's not enough to fully ensure we avert, you know, planetary calamity. But she was still talking it up. So that gives me a bit of optimism that progressives are going to, and I think because they have told themselves the alternative was getting nothing, they're more willing to accept something and praise something.
So you think November, you think that this is on the same track as the government funding stuff?
And the debt ceiling, most importantly, which presumably is December 3rd, maybe gets bumped up a little bit, but in that area.
Oh, man,
you got money riding on this. Do you need to know exactly what the date is so you can get a good payoff?
No. I do have a beer riding on it. My friend Jen Briney of the Congressional Dish podcast was very much of the belief as the progressives had a message that with no leverage, that means that there's no deal on BBB. And I was like, no, I still think that BBB is too big to fail. Now what BBB is it more salt cuts than Green New Deal by the time that it actually becomes law? That I think remains an open question. And that is something that I think progressives might be upset about by the end of it. But I do think it passes. I do agree with you.
They're there to use the cross. But I think this past weekend, Democrats have not had a good day. There's not been a good headline day for Biden and the Democrats since the pullout of Afghanistan in early August. It's been three months, you know, politically dry in a political desert, and they have suffered from it. Their numbers have suffered by having this lack of forward momentum. And, you know, obviously, you know, COVID and frustrations with continuing mask mandates and whatnot are part of that. But it's all intertwined. If there isn't a feeling that you're working on it and getting things done and moving the ball forward, people start wondering what the hell are you in there for. So my guess is Democrats like the feeling of winning, the feeling of getting a bill passed. I don't think they're eager to have another round of circular firing squad by killing this thing.
There's also the fact that there's a ticking clock, right? Like, we're now a year away from midterms. Historically, not a lot of big legislative movement happens past, well, like now, you know, we are in the waning days of wheeling and dealing. Like, I get the sense that if something doesn't pass by the end of the year, it's only going to get exponentially tougher every hour from that.
Well, there's another deadline, which is that the enhanced child tax credit and the enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies, which were in the American Rescue Plan at the front of the year, they expire at the end of December. So these extra checks that you get for your kids, they get cut off without a new bill. And so I think that is another deadline that Democrats are very cognizant of. Now, but to your other point, it's arguably a little dangerous to have nothing going forward for the entirety of 2022. Yeah. Granted, if you pass American Rescue Plan, Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, and Build Back Better, you know, that's a term. You know, that there's a lot of stuff with those things.
Yeah.
You can rightly pat yourself on the back for, but it's still tough, I think, to go through a whole 11-month period with doing nothing else legislatively. And I am curious to see if Republicans recalibrate here, if Republicans take away some lessons from Virginia and from the passage of the infrastructure bill. Do the 13 to vote yes look good in their home districts for doing that? Do other Republicans say, you know what, we can, what Republicans did, what did they not do in September and October? They did not do a government shutdown when they could have.
Yeah.
They did not do a highway trust fund shutdown when they could have. They kept things kind of chill so Youngkin could not be a Trumper. I mean, the last time Terry McAuliffe won Virginia, 8 years ago in 2013, you know, he wasn't a great candidate back then. He was still a used car salesman, DNC hack Terry McAuliffe, and he couldn't even get 50% of the vote. But he won because Republicans had just done the most idiotic, ludicrous government shutdown in history, trying to squeeze Obama to defund Obamacare. Talk about misreading your adversary. Yeah. He's not going to defund a signature achievement. They looked like idiots. Their numbers tanked. They caved. Less than a month before the Virginia election, and McAuliffe ekes it out. Republicans did not make that mistake this time around. They did not play the shutdown card this time around. So do some Republicans say, you know what, we can work together on some things, and you know what, it's going to be a good midterm for us anyway, because it's almost always a good midterm for the out party. So why not risk fate? Why should we give Democrats reason to make us the bad guy? We can throw them a couple of bones, and we're still going to win our seats anyway. I'm not predicting this by any stretch, Republicans should look at Virginia and say, you know what, Democrats, they got rid of voter ID. They enhanced early voting. They enfranchised almost 300,000 ex-felons. And we won. We won in that state. They controlled all the election apparatus. They were the Secretary of State. They didn't rig the election for them. They made it easier to vote. And we juiced our base and we flipped some swing voters and we won. There's no reason to believe that the Democrats' proposals for voting rights is designed to help Democrats over Republicans. I mean, they want to negotiate and still narrow things down to some degree. But I think there's a real opening there for a bipartisan bill, because I mean, this is the way Republicans should think about it. When you make it easier to vote, you can capitalize on political pendulum swings a lot easier because your low propensity voters can come out more easily. The winds are in their corner, baby. This is a Republican year brewing. This is a red wave brewing. Make it easier for your people to vote and you might extend your gains.
Well, that is going to be an interesting question specifically as you have all these midterms coming out and a looming force in the Republican Party that only wants to talk about election security in the Mar-a-Lago constituency.
The question, do people step, does Joe Manchin, because right, talking about, you know, what did Manchin do right or wrong here?
Yeah.
The infrastructure bill came together because Manchin and Sinema and Republicans wrote the bill together. That's how bipartisan things happen. Voting rights, Manchin has been working with Democrats, coming up with a compromise with them, and then handing it to Republicans saying, would you guys be for this? Well, of course, the answer is no, because they weren't in the room. I think Manchin could start over using Virginia as a data point. Say, look, we can do this in a way that's not going to hurt you, could well help you and make you look like more palatable to swing voters. And I have still reason to want to do this because we have base voters that want to do it too. We can serve we have mutual interest here. And so let's go forward together as we do with infrastructure. But someone's got to step up and be a leader there. And that has not happened on voting rights yet. And it hasn't happened on immigration. And it hasn't happened on climate. Things where I think there actually are potential openings, but we haven't seen the leadership. So I'm hardly projecting it because I haven't seen the motion there. But I think the openings exist if people try.
Bill Scheer, writer, Washington Monthly. What do you have coming up?
I am working on a piece for the Washington Monthly about trust, going through where the mistrust was stated publicly and did not serve interest, and when trust materialized, how everyone benefited. And so hopefully that might help folks, you know, take some good lessons away from this process.
Well, I know whenever that we talk metaphorically, my arms are open, my eyes are closed, and I'm trust falling into the waiting arms of Bill Scheer. Thank you so much, man. Always a pleasure.
Same here. Take care.
And that'll wrap it up for us today. Politics, Politics, Politics is written and hosted by me, Justin Robert Young, for Dog and Pony Show Audio in Austin, Texas. If you would like to say thank you to Bill Scheer for sharing his expertise, you can do so by heading on over to px3guest.com. You want to email the show, it is theyoungamerican@gmail.com. Love responding to everybody who sends an email. If you would like to follow the show on Twitter, it is px3tweets. If you want to follow us on Twitter, it is px3live. And you can share this podcast with friends, family, and anyone else at px3podcast.com. With the holiday season approaching, there's only one place where you can get Politics, Politics, Politics merch for you and yours, and that is at politicsmerch.com. If you want to support the show with a one-time donation, you can do so at paypal.me/payjury. On Venmo, you can find out whether or not Venmo Cash is real. I contend that it still is an open question and we should teach the controversy. So if, let's say, you head on over and you're a Douglas who said, I just checked my bank account and it's now down $2. This must be real money. Yes. And Douglas who sent it to my Venmo, Justin-Young-20. How are you getting that your bank account number is real? Makes you think, IMO. Continue with this scientific rigor and send a dollar to Justin-Young-20 on Venmo. On Cash App, it's PX3Cash, and you can send me checks, gifts, or anything else in the mail physically to P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas 78715. You can only get bonus content of this show at our Patreon, and that is at TakePoliticsSeriously.com. $3 tier gets you 2 bonus podcasts per week, covering all the news that we miss on our free podcast schedule. And the $10 tier gets your name right at the end of the podcast, like these fine folks in the Titanic. $10 tier. Idris Arslanian, DJ Katie Mack, Niemeister, Dr. G, Lord Scale, Dakin Sayanile, Admiral Flapjack, Utah Jimmy Montana, Edmund Pluribus Unum, Pete Spicery, 70s TV Salesman, or Spy. D, really? And Gloria Young for King of the New World Order. Zombie Doc, Edison, No Mention of the Podcast, Please, .com Junkie, DP4 Bongo, Jewish Lives Matter, 100 Mile Runner, Staff Sergeant Poopers, Double K Ranch, Pop Gold, Ye Old Pinball Shop, John Snuffies, Off Route 44, Super Zoomy, Neil, Charles, Darren, Olin and Angela, DL, Steven, Chad, Miranda Janelle, Chief Andy, Robert, Casey, Paul, Richard, D Laser, Just Another Pilot, Middle Age Mike, The Gen, Will, J Pink, and Andrew. If you would like to join their ranks, only one place to do it: TakePoliticsSeriously@gmail.com. Guys, that's a wrap for today. So on Friday, we are going to have Evan Scrimshaw. I often call him Eric by accident. It's not Eric Scrimshaw. It's Evan Scrimshaw. Columnist for the Lines, political better extraordinaire. He's got to eat a little crow on Virginia. He was very chesty about Virginia, about how McAuliffe was going to win. So we go over where he was wrong there, how he is reassessing his global effing realignment strategy, and do some breaking down. Is there value early in the midterm season? On betting. I mean, spoiler alert, apparently all of the candidates that were put into toss-up races by Crystal Ball, all the Democrats that currently hold the seats, these are incumbents in Arizona, Georgia, and Nevada. They're all underdogs in the betting market. If I were somebody who liked to bet on politics, I might take those three as underdogs. Because you got to figure at least 2 out of the 3 of them are going to win. And just be smart. I don't know. All right. That'll about wrap it up for us today. Until next time, this is your old pal, Justin Robert Young, saying some shows talk about politics, others talk about politics, and still more discuss politics. But this is the only show that dares discuss
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.